On July 11th, 2021, a loud call for freedom was heard on the streets of communist-ruled Cuba. Fed up with 62 years of nada, nothing, but Castro communism, oppression, and scarcity, what does the future hold for the people long robbed of any opportunities? How did we get here? What we learned? And can we finally be free? SOS Cuba is a weekly six-episode series hosted by me, Enrique Santos, and Telemundo and NBC journalist José Díaz-Balart. We invite you to join us, our guests, social influencers, artists, and journalists from the island, as well as the global exile community, as we dive deep into the history that shaped us and talk patria, vida, libertad, and human rights in Cuba. Talking about July 11th, Jose, you've covered and cover constantly international events and uprisings in countries. What surprised you the most of what happened July 11th in Cuba as a Cuban-American?
The extraordinary nature of it. You know, we see people taking to the streets and asking for freedom. And, you know, if you are someone who doesn't pay a lot of attention to what's been going on in Cuba, you would think, well, that's similar to what we're seeing in other places. I mean, there are people taking to the streets in the United States for just causes all the time. But it's the extraordinary nature of the fact that these people went to the streets asking for freedom almost in one voice, in unison, knowing that that simple act could very well cost them up to their life. Because in Cuba, the act of speaking against the government can carry all kinds of penalties. You could lose your home. You probably will lose, if you have a job, your job. Your family will lose everything. Go to prison or worse. And yet there they were, in unison, asking for one thing, freedom. It was such an unusual moment in a world where those kinds of things we're used to seeing, right? That's what I think was surprising to me, just how unique that was.
Is that sentiment, is that movement fading out, or is it just getting started?
I think that in Cuba, it's continuing, and it's continuing on a daily basis. I mean, we have, you know, reporters in Cuba, independent reporters, who are in house arrest, essentially. Luz, who we very much admire, has children, can't leave her apartment. And there's a state security officer down there not letting her out. You know, there are people today suffering because of their desire to speak freely.
How much more does that make you appreciate what you do in this great country, that you're able to report and say what you feel? And in both English and in Spanish, you're one of the leading, if not the most important and recognizable face and voice, not only in English, but in Spanish media when it comes to news, and most respected, I'd say. Aparte de que eres mi gran amigo, you're a very dear friend. When you see that you see a journalist that does what, that tries to do what you do freely here in this country, and it has a, you know, seguridad del Estado waiting for her, trying to tell her, you don't want to go outside. There's COVID outside. You better go back upstairs. This intimidation, this control.
It's another reaffirmation of how privileged we are to be able to live in a country that, with all of the problems it may have, give us the opportunity to fulfill our dreams and to search for our aspirations on our own terms. Enrique, you know, you couldn't do what you do there. And you couldn't express yourself. You couldn't live, you and I, nobody could live our lives inside that country. It's an amazing thing to think about. It's not just that you have different opinions. It's that we couldn't live our lives inside that country. And yet there are 11 million people who are forced to live lives created by a cupola in power that tells them how to think, how to act, when to eat, what to eat, when to go to get some kind of health. There is no health system that is working. So every aspect of their lives is told to them by a group in power that has no relationship with the people. And it's really amazing to think about that reality is happening 90 miles away from the United States. And yet we share that blood, people that were from and are from that island, but they're not able to live anyway their lives. And that's a really remarkable thought in 2021, that there are people today that cannot have dreams, aspirations, hopes for the future. They're just not allowed to have it. It's kind of a weird thing to think about. And I'm very, every day, very grateful to be able to fight for my dreams and aspirations, right? Just like you are.
Is it hard separating or controlling those, your passion and your thoughts when you're reporting on issues like this?
Look, I've always...
Because you're so tied to it personally?
Yeah, I've always been aware of the fact that in journalism, I'm doing a service. It's not about me. It's not about what I think or don't think. That's for a conversation with friends. But my responsibility is to serve through journalism. Journalism, you do have to search for the truth. And that truth includes maybe uncomfortable things for some people. So I've always been clear that my role as a journalist is to search for the truth. And so I don't see any contradiction ever, anything in my life regarding what I have to do.
Not to go off topic, but is it difficult as a journalist in times where everyone creates their own truth or believes what they want to believe?
Journalism has never been more important. I think that it's never been more important for a society. And without free press, there can be no free country. And so it frustrates me, yes, that the preponderance of invented things that can be sometimes seen as being truth by some people is a battle that we as journalists have to fight. In other words, we have to constantly be aware of the fact that there are a lot of different sources of misinformation that are constantly being put out there. And never has that been more of a problem, I think, than nowadays. What do you think?
I think it's sad not just in our country, but globally, that people, you grow up as a kid respecting your elders, respecting doctors, respecting science, and then to have people, I think there's nothing wrong with questioning things. You know, you go to a doctor, you get a second opinion on something, but I never heard of, first time in my lifetime that I see people, you're telling me I have to take this pill because this pill's going to make me better? Uh-uh. I'm not going to take this pill. This pill's not going to make me better. You know, more than a doctor does.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, unfortunately, it's been a reality of since mankind existed. I mean, there were snake oil salesmen throughout history. And, you can go to excavations in ancient Egypt and you're going to find, pots of old medicine that were nothing more than olive oil with a few seeds of something in there, right?
Right, but it makes sense. In ancient times, I think it's acceptable. But in current
because day, the world is different.
The information that we have, and yet, because the information is so readily accessible to us, and the real information, and research, and proven history proves, and science can prove or disprove something. But the fact that people refuse to accept that truth and create their own reality, it just boggles my mind.
Oh, that's a great conversation to have, because
that's another podcast.
No, and it's yet it's one of the real major issues that we as a society, wherever we are confronting. Less in Cuba, because in Cuba only one person, one entity controls everything.
Right. There's only one story being told.
Exactly.
Right.
And it's not the truth necessarily.
Sadly. Well, the truth is decades of repression and total control and manipulation. Cubans can't take it anymore. Cuban artist Michael Osorbo told me a couple months before the July 11th uprising that he was ready to die for his freedom. And ironically, he has since been jailed and is currently one of Cuba's political prisoners.
El cambio real, radical, a una democracia, va a venir del cubano que está dentro de la isla. Y ese es mi deber. Aunque pierda el cuerpo, hermano, aunque pierda la vida, mi deber es decirle al cubano que está dentro de la isla, basta ya. Tú tienes que salir para la calle. Hacerte saber, Enrique, que tanto yo como Luis Manuel tenemos el cuerpo. El cuerpo de nosotros no existe. Lo único que nosotros dominamos es la mente y el corazón. Pero el cuerpo quizás en cualquier momento lo perdamos. Yo y Luis Manuel estamos altos para perder el cuerpo. No importa. Pero la idea va a ser la misma, básica. Libertad. No más dictadura, no más Castro. Libertad. No dialogamos. Con los Castros no se dialoga. Con los delincuentes no se dialoga. Patria y vida, mi hermano. Y súper conectado ahora.
¡Vida! ¡Patria y vida!
¡Abajo la dictadura! ¡Abajo los Castros!
All right, let's welcome two of the leading voices, Cuban-American voices, that here in the United States have helped organize, Jose, voices on the East Coast and the West Coast. They're Cuban-American brothers. I respect them a lot. They're true friends. Jason and Giancarlo Canelas join us today. Gentlemen, how are you?
We're doing great, brother. We're doing great. Thank you for having us. We really appreciate it.
I like that the older brother always speaks first. That's important.
Hey, you know, it's seniority. I have to, I got to give it up to him.
I mean, I gave him two seconds. I saw that he didn't step in. So I said, let me step up.
Let's start with Giancarlo. Giancarlo, el 11 de julio, 11th of July, why was that date important to you? And what changed? Because you, me, your brother, Jose's been doing a lot, all of us that love and enjoy and respect liberty and democracy have been doing a lot for our brothers and sisters in the island. What did July 11th mean to you?
Well said. July 11th, to me, represents the beginning of the end of an era, of a brutal era that has lasted way too long. I think that it was always within the Cuban community, there was always a divisiveness, you know, between the Miami Cubans and the Cubans on the island. You know, I grew up listening to that. And I think that what July 11th did was it unified us. Cubans in Miami, Cubans on the island, it made the message more clear than ever. You know, in 62 years, we hadn't seen those types of manifestations coming from the island, coming from the people that were doctrined by this regime, coming from the people that there was always a doubt of how much of Cuba actually wants to change, you know. And we saw on July 11th that the majority of Cubans, they've had enough. They can't take it anymore. They can't take the abuse anymore. They can't take the oppressions anymore. They can't take the brutality anymore. And they literally cannot breathe with the knee of this dictatorship on their necks, and they said enough is enough. They took to the streets. They did not ask for vaccines. They did not ask for food. They did not ask for water. They asked for a systematic change. And I think that what we saw on July 11th was the beginning of many more manifestations to come. The way the regime handled those manifestations, as they've historically done, fractured the little relationship that was left between the Cuban people and the Castro regime.
Giancarlo has been on the East Coast organizing a lot of the demonstrations that we've seen, a lot of the marches as well. And your brother Jason is on the West Coast in Los Angeles doing the very same for the people of Cuba. What did this, what has this movement mean to you, this historic day in Cuba, Jason?
Well, brother, I mean, it's going to be a lot of what my brother just said, but to not repeat the same thing, which is exactly how I feel, I'll just add that, you know, this obviously July 11th is a monumental day for our people, considering that, you know, they finally said enough. They finally came out. But it's important to understand, obviously we understand, but it's important that the people who don't know much about what's happening or what has been happening understand that this is something that has been going on for 60 plus years. You know, July 11th was just the pot boiling over. Our parents, our grandparents, our generation, this is three generations that have been robbed of their freedom. My grandparents died dreaming of a free Cuba. You know, Giancarlo's, my sister, Annette, Eric, myself, we grew up, you know, being told the stories, same way that I'm sure you guys and many people hearing this grew up, you know, hearing the stories of what our parents went through, what our grandparents went through. And, you know, for me, I always felt so proud to be Cuban, but I never really understood the root of it all until July 11th. When I saw those images come off the island and I saw the oppression, like firsthand, like really seeing the faces of the Cuban people, you know, as they marched with the courage of, you know, looking down the barrel of a gun and screaming Patria y Vida and knowing the consequences. Like, I think that was the first time in 29 years of my life that I truly was able to put faces to the stories that my grandparents told me, that my parents told me, because up until July 11th, all I ever was able to use was my imagination. And man, seeing those images and seeing the kids, seeing the, you know, the aggression that the regime has unleashed on its people, man, it's really struck me in a way to where there's absolutely no way that I could just stay put. I have to use my voice. I have to, you know, do whatever I can. And thankfully, so many young people have come together. Cubans, Venezuelans, Nicaraguans, and a lot of first generation, which has, you know, it fills me up with so much freaking happiness to see that my generation is actually understanding the importance of this and that we're coming together and that we're trying to spread awareness. You know, I think the regime never in a million years envisioned the kids of the exiles feeling that same burning passion for Cuba to come out on the streets and to speak up all around the world. And I think that, you know, July 11th was a big victory for the Cuban people, considering, you know, what it means and what it started. And this is going to be a long fight, and we're committed to going to battle for as long as we have to.
You described it well, because as Cuban Americans, I think we all feel the same. It's kind of like we feel respect for our grandparents, right? And for all the exiled Cuban community that hasn't been able to see a free Cuba, that, you know, we have our grandparents that are now unfortunately dying without having been able to return, that our parents, like in Jose's, in your case, Jose, has passed, right? So we kind of feel like it's a great sense of responsibility. It's our turn to step up to the plate.
And that's the unique part of this. In so many things, El 11 de Julio changed things. It changed things inside Cuba, but I think it also, looking at these two brothers, changed a lot of people outside of Cuba. And I wanted to kind of get a gauge from both of you, something that Jason, you talked about you didn't really understand it in your pores what your parents and grandparents talked so much about until you saw it the past 11th of July. And what is it about that 11th of July?
But you know what? It's also as when we grow up as kids, we always hear our parents, en Cuba todo era mejor, en Cuba todo era más grande, in Cuba this used to happen this way and
right,
this.
Right.
So it's kind of, and then you kind of like, you got it.
So what is it? What it is feels, the prompt?
Yeah. I want to say something
really quick. Like, and Jen is going to understand this because I'm talking about our parents here. You know, our family has been through a lot, you know, over the years, same as any family, I think. And we've always had the utmost respect and admiration for both my father and my mother, you know, seeing the struggle, seeing everything that they've gone through, you know, losing two kids, and just, you know, overcoming the obstacles that life has always thrown at them, the way that life throws obstacles at us. But for me, like these last couple of weeks, you know, just really understanding the weight that they've had to carry on their shoulders these last 50 plus years, having left, you know, their home. You know, again, you said it. I never really understood in my pores the pain and the trauma that they have lived with all these years. You know, my mom left as an 11-year-old girl, and her parents told her, don't unpack. You know, we're coming back at the end of the month. That month went by. It was like, hey, don't unpack. Just use whatever you got to use, but we're going back. It's been 50 plus years. They never went back. My grandfather died. My grandmother died. My mom did everything she could to stay in contact with her family and help them over the years. And I had to see my mom mourn the loss of her uncle and her cousin, you know, within 10 days of each other these last 2 weeks from COVID because they couldn't get access to an oxygen tank. And to see my mom that devastated because she couldn't do anything, you know, like it shows you the real like atrocity that this regime will be held accountable for so many things, for the murders, for the political prisoners, for everything. But the one thing that I believe is at the top of the list, considering at least where my values stand, nothing in this world is more important to me than family, than unity. And this regime has separated. I mean, I can't put a number on it, but the separation of family, you know, to me is one of the most horrendous things that anybody could do. And when you talk about the amount of families that have been literally destroyed because of this regime, there's no word to describe that pain. And we're seeing it. I mean, I just cannot imagine being separated from my family for 50 plus years. I don't understand. For me to not be able to see my brother or my sister, or my parents, like I don't even know. I really do not know how.
You have to also, we have to also take into consideration, Jose, based on what you said, you know, talking about why is first generation Cubans, why do we feel this way? Look, I remember growing up as a young artist, you know, growing up in a Cuban family, which, by the way, I believe that we come into this world with a purpose. I believe that we're born within a Cuban family for a reason, or within a Mexican family for a reason. I believe we come with purpose, and I proud take on that purpose and responsibility of being the son of Cuban immigrants. You know, everyone has a different story. This is our story. This is our duty, you know, and I believe that, you know, as first generation Cubans, I grew up seeing my friends from Colombia when they were little saying, oh, I'm going to go this summer with my parents to their home country, to Colombia. Oh, I'm going to go to Mexico. Oh, I'm going to go here. Oh, I'm going to go there. I was never able to do that. We were never able to do that. We were never able to go vacation in the homeland where it all started, in the blood that runs through our veins. And it's like they instill such a huge love in us as Cuban Americans for our roots. It's like introducing you to the love of your life and then telling you that you could never meet her and you may never be able to, you know? And it's a big void that we grow up with. And I think that those images that we saw on July 11th, it reminded us of the frustration that of seeing how, look, in Puerto Rico, when the manifestations happened to throw out the governor that was there at the time, they were able to manifest. There was no police beating them on the streets. And a month later, he was out, because that's what a democracy looks like. You know, that's what a system that actually is there for the people and by the people looks like. To see these images and to feel that no matter how much we do, you know, we can't be there for them. We can't just get on a plane and go, because what's the strategy there? How is that going to make a difference? It's very frustrating. It's very painful, you know, but let me tell you this, and let me just add to that. We can't stop. We can't stop. We can't let that be a crutch. We can't let that be the reason why we give up, because social media has become a huge ally for us. I believe that July 11th, what it did is it unveiled a truth about this system to not just us as Cubans that were already exposed to this truth, but to the world. A lot of people, we've seen the romantic, you know, fictitious story that through propaganda this regime has fed to the whole world. And like you said, in Los Angeles or in Europe, you see people with Che Guevara shirts and they just don't understand the whole truth. So for me, July 11th, what it did, and along with the tool of social media, along with all of our voices collectively caring about this, caring about democracy, it unveiled the truth about this regime to a lot of people that were living a complete lie when it comes to the reality in Cuba.
We are very proud of our next guest. She is actually the first tenured Latina professor at UPenn's Graduate School of Education, an Ivy School at that, Dr. Amalia Dache. Thank you for being here with us today.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure and an honor to be on this show.
It's such an important topic. Doctor, July 11th in Cuba, a movement or a moment?
It is a movement, for sure. And I studied movements. I've studied movements since 2014 when we had the Ferguson uprising in 2014 because of police violence. And very similar to what's happening in Cuba now, when you think about the repression and the history of repression when it comes to the police state towards the Cuban people, there is a racial dynamic. And so that's something I'm very familiar with when it comes to movements happening around the world, but again, more in particular to the U.S. and of course now in Cuba.
And we've been shut off from the world. You know, Jose and I have been talking about this doctor for such a long time. And it's so frustrating, too, to see so many of our actors and actresses and musicians and poets that never internationalized because of this dictatorship. That we are just now, you know, within the past several years, getting to know more of, thanks to social media, right? Thanks to the internet finally coming. Porque antes era un cuento. No, ahí le caen a golpes a la gente. Ten cuidado, las damas de blanca son arrastradas por el pelo, por la dama, tú sabes, por las calles de Cuba. Ya no es un cuento, se ve, y todavía hoy en día la dictadura trata de frenar que esos videos salgan, bloqueando el internet y demás. But this is very real, and there's a lot of pain, and it's very deep, and it's very real, and it's so sad. It really is so sad.
And this pain and this history, again, thinking about a post, you know, dictatorship, all of this is going to be a part of the new Cuba, right? This is what's going to shape. This is what's going to make it an organic process that, again, we can learn from these other models, South Africa, post-Soviet context. But we also have our own autonomy, right? That's coming out of even right now, right? We're making history right now. This is going to shape the history of Cuba. You know, J11 is a movement. It's a movement that's happening, and it's an organic process that's going to shape, you know, the new democracy that emerges from the work that we're doing in the diaspora, from the international commitments. I mean, we haven't even talked about, you know, how silenced, you know, the rest of the world is when it comes to Cuba, as far as supporting Cuba and putting pressure on España and putting pressure on Italy and putting pressure on those who actually do business in Cuba, without thinking about the human rights abuses and the repression that is happening to the Cuban population. Like, how are we going to hold these governments in these countries accountable? And how do we get international support? I mean, I think this is one way, right? Like awareness, continual media attention, especially those of us who, you know, are in positions where we have, carry a lot of weight because of our institutions. But, you know, there's got to be political accountability as well.
There's so much... You really scratch your head. You think, why should we have to? It's like pulling teeth to, you know, to try to just to get people to open up their, not even their eyes, their hearts to something that's happening. It's a real time genocide happening on our, and it's up to us, right, to step up to the plate. And you would think that these kind of things, se caen de la mata, Cubans say, right? This is just as just human, good people, just good human beings saying, caramba, these people are hurting. Let me raise my voice. Like Jose and I were talking a little while ago as well. There's certain things that you can be quiet and silent upon, and it's okay and acceptable. This is not one of those moments. This is not one of those things that is acceptable for anyone to stay mute on.
If we care about human rights, if we care about civil rights, then this should not be an issue we should be silent on.
Doctor, always remembering Solzhenitsyn wrote the Gulag Archipelago. Well, Cuba has been living as a Gulag Archipelago for 62 years, and it's only when the Solzhenitsyns of the world are published outside that gulag that things can at least start to change in at least some world solidarity.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Again, the writing, the art, the music. And I'm thinking about there was an obra that Luis Manuel Otero Alcantara did in April of 2021. Do you remember? It yeah. was when he did the... It was the one where he actually had a mechanism that was used for oppression during the colonial period. It was called garroteville. It was a garroteville. Think about that. There's a racial dynamic too for that, right? The fact that he used this garroteville, used it, positioned himself inside of it, put himself inside of his home, and said for the police to come, if you're going to lynch me, then I've given you the tools to do that, right? But this tool, this garro de vil, was actually used during the colonial period in Cuba for los esclavos. And so, again, you have the artists. The artists are using their voice to talk about these social, racial processes that are so intertwined in Cuba under the political repression that we have to hear their voices. And yes, they're the ones that are documenting what's happening. There's los artistas and the journalists and those who are using the pen as a weapon almost, right? Using art as a weapon, using the pen as a weapon. And exactly, this is being published and the youth are putting it out and the people are putting it out. And it's a very, again, it's a very organic and intertwined process between social actors.
Doctora, thank you for your time. You know, there's a saying, we always say, what is it? Being the smartest person in the room. We are honored with your presence and with Jose's as well. And I feel like the dumbest person in the room.
Oh, right
no. Now. Doctora, thank you.
Doctor, I also have to thank you because, you know what? There are so many layers in the Cuban reality. There are so many under the skin layers of Cuban reality that have to be exposed. And thank you for your voice. Thank you for your knowledge. Thank you for sharing it with us. I think that all of us, at least I know speaking for Enrique, we've learned a lot.
Yes.
And that's the best gift that you could give, and you've given it to us.
Well, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate all of the conversations that we've had today related to these topics. And I want to just end on this note. I want to think about my father. My father was one of the first political prisoners in Cuba that used the tool of challenging the regime through driving a bus into the American embassy and being imprisoned for that in 1965. So I think about the history of my father's resistance and how he used protest to challenge the regime in 1965. And seeing that being present in the 80s and the 90s, and now through social media and through, you know, Cubanos being on the street, I think that, you know, I owe that to the legacy of all of the Cubanos that, you know, that have been, you know, imprisoned and also have been, you know, detained. So just wanted to shout out my own family legacy in this struggle.
Thank you very much, Doctor. I think that's what we're all trying to do, right? Continue the legacy of our parents, of our grandparents.
Yes.
God bless your father, rest his soul. Muchas gracias.
Thank you.
Let's talk to one of Cuba's biggest artists. He's one of the very few Cuban artists that have been able to take his music, his talents, and internationalize it. Le ha molestado la dictadura todo lo que has hecho y lo que sigues haciendo por los cubanos. Gracias por estar aquí con nosotros.
Gracias, gracias.
Te admiro, amigo. Gracias.
Un placer, amigo. Yo creo que el 11 de julio el pueblo cubano dijo, no aguanto más. Se acabó. O sea, es como, yo le digo a la gente, ¿sabes por qué explota una olla de presión? ¿Sabes por qué explota?
Por la presión adentro, ¿no?
Pero
no aguanta
¿sabes
más.
¿Sabes cuándo es que explota?
¿Cuándo?
Uno nunca sabe.
Exactamente.
A veces la
escuchas el pitillo, ¿no?
Sí. Y tú dices, creo que es esto. Y a lo mejor te dicen, no, ¿sabes qué pasó? Que el frijol, ¡pa! Y eso fue lo que... Entonces, esa olla estaba a punto de explotar. Y bastó que saliera a la calle la gente, que se conectaran por internet, que vieran que, mira lo que está pasando, mira... Y todo el mundo fuera a la calle.
Es importante también mencionar que el hashtag SOS Cuba hizo tanto, llamó tanto la atención.
Mucho.
Y que se compartió el día antes por artistas.
Y
su gran mayoría que no son artistas cubanos, exactamente. Urbanos, pero
artistas urbanos.
La mayoría de ellos puertorriqueños, vamos a hablar
claro. ¿Tú sabes por qué te digo urbano? Porque es muy importante, porque Patria Vieja es un tema de hip hop. Otro tema que también cantaron, que fueron de los Haitianos, Díaz Canel, su apellido, también es un tema de hip hop. Y todos los artistas urbanos colaboran. O sea, bro, el rap es eso. No nos olvidemos que el rap nace en Estados Unidos para precisamente eso. Denunciar, hablar, estar en contra de los opresores.
Una música protesta.
Exacto. Entonces, cuando los urbanos empiezan a taggear Daddy Yankee, Balvin, Arcángel, Ozuna, todos, o sea, los chamacos cubanos dicen, oye, nos están mirando. Lo estamos observando.
También había Patria y Vida, que eso
claro.
Yo creo que era quizás el detonante,
claro.
Porque hay que identificarse con un mensaje,
exacto.
Hay que tener palabras con sentido, y esa canción le dio palabras con sentido a muchísima gente que no sabía exactamente qué es lo que querían decir.
No, y sobre todo, porque venimos de patria o muerte. ¿Tú me entiendes? O sea, a mí la palabra muerte nunca me ha gustado. Pero no es menos cierto que este 2020 arrancó con esa palabra muy presente. O sea, antes nos decían, no, hubo una explosión en no sé dónde y tal, decía, es muy lejos, pero la muerte nos ha tocado a todos muy cerquita, ya sean familiares, amigos, conocí gente muy cercana. Entonces, cuando tú escuchas patria o muerte, tú vuelves a escuchar esa palabra tétrica que es la muerte, y al tú decir patria y vida, como que es como que, wow, es como un aire de esperanza, pero no solamente por cambiar la vida por la muerte, porque eso siempre tiene que ser canjeable, sino cambiar la I por la O. Esa O de patria o muerte dice mucho. Es o tú o yo, uh-huh. O mi programa o el tuyo, o mi pensamiento o el tuyo, o incluso mi raza o la tuya. Patria y vida no, patria y vida es tú y yo, tu pensamiento es mío, tu condición sexual y la mía, tu raza y la mía, tú y yo, tu idea y la mía, tu diferencia y mi diferencia.
Cuando sale la canción y tú ves que el régimen prohíbe que el cubano diga patria y vida.
Yo dije, eso va a ser un palo. Era las palabras necesarias para convertirla en todo un éxito. Y después no, y después la acusación, y después todas las canciones que han sacado para intentar matar el lo que, ¿tú sabes qué pasa con Patria y Vida? Que el cubano vio un plan de futuro. Eso fue lo que pasó con Patria y Vida. Un plan de futuro es, esto es lo que yo quiero, Patria y Vida. Es cuando tú estás en la casa y tu mujer te dice, si nos compramos un chalet y un coche, tú no te imaginas que venga y dice, wow, tú dibujas tu plan de futuro. Patria y Vida dibujó un plan de futuro en todos los cubanos, pero no en los cubanos en la isla, en los cubanos aquí también.
All right, listen, to the Cuban exile community, cariñosamente lo llamamos Willy. Willy Chirino. He's so much more than that. He's a Cuban, simple, he's, para describir, es que no hay una palabra que pueda describir, no se puede describir Willy Chirino fácilmente. This man is a Cuban-American musician, performer, who arrived in the United States through the famed Peter Pan flights that brought so many of Cuba's youth escaping military inscription and indoctrination at the beginning of the Castro Revolution. Willy Chirino never, ever, ever forgets his country or his home in Consolación del Sur, in Pinar del Río, which he's evoked in all of his songs. Almost every single one of Willy Chirino's songs, he mentions his beautiful homeland throughout his beautiful career of 62 years of exile here in the United States. After July 11th, I remember Willy Chirino doing a live on Instagram that touched my heart. And I think about it, and I still, yeah,
emocionas. Emocionas.
I still get sentimental because, sí. Sorry, Willy, tú dijiste algo muy importante. Tú dijiste, and I'll never forget, and estoy todos los días desde el 11 de julio, repite la voz de Willy Chirino en mi mente. Willy's voice continuously bounces in my head after his live that he did on Instagram when Willy said, I've been saying this for 62 years. I've been screaming this through my music. Ya vienen llegando. In every one of my songs, wherever, in every single stage that I stand on, I fight for it, for Cuba and his people. And Willy said, and I'm asking God, le estoy pidiendo a Dios en este momento que me alumbre y me diga qué rol debe jugar Willy Chirino en este momento histórico de Cuba. And that's what I've been asking myself every single day. What role do I need to play as a Cuban American? So grateful that this country opens its arms to my parents and to my grandparents. So Willy, thank you for everything that you do. Thank you for those beautiful words. Thank you for being here with Jose and I in this project SOS Cuba, this podcast where we're hoping to shed some light on the Cuban tragedy and hoping that, you know, the voices like yours don't go mute, don't go silent. I thank you and I respect you so much, Willy. Thank you for being here.
I am very happy to be here with you, two good friends for a long time, which I respect and I admire. And I thank you also for being part of this and helping keep the flame alive that started in Cuba. We must, as I have said before, do whatever it is that we can to keep those that flame alive. I quote Jose Marti quite a bit because to me he's an inspiration in every aspect of my life. And he once said, I'll say it in Spanish, I'll try to translate it later. He said, cuando de la libertad se trata, todo al fuego, hasta el arte para alimentar la hoguera. And that is referring to a lot of people that say that, you know, you can't mingle politics and music and arts and stuff like that. And it's just the opposite. When you're dealing with freedom, with liberty, like we have been for 62 and a half years, you know, you always fall back to, I at least fall back to those words which say, hasta el arte. When we're dealing with freedom, everything to flame the fire, even the arts. So that's what I'm doing. I'm trying through my music. I've been doing it for a long time, but especially now that, you know, the Cuban people finally decided to wake up and have the, you know, the audacity to go to the streets and fight for their freedom. We must be here on this side, outside the island, trying to help whatever it is that we can to get the message across, to get those images seen by millions of people around the world so they can actually grasp, you know, the sad situation that the Cubans have been living for so long.
Does it surprise you, Willie, that this new movement and awakening in Cuba was started not by politicians, not by radio broadcasters, or it was started by el pueblo, it was started by musicians such as yourself, and through the power of social media with the hashtag SOS Cuba y Patria y Vida? ¿Te sorprende eso, Willy?
It started by artists, M27, San Isidro, el Movimiento San Isidro, those, yes, those artists, musicians, are plastic painters, and writers and novelists, poets, and that's what it is. We must, you know, use our tools, nuestro arte, para alimentar la hoguera que se encendió el 11 de junio en Cuba, which is very important to us.
Willy, cuando tú comenzaste tu carrera, y además, you know, it's important to kind of underline that Willy Chirino is the creator of the Miami music sound. You know, he is it. And Willy, why is it that you focused always on issues such as Cuba, freedom, and the need for people to live free when you're starting a career that, well, those kinds of issues weren't really talked
popular,
about,
right? They weren't popular. Yeah. Not cool to sing about at, correct, that moment. Let's be honest.
Because not cool. I totally agree, and it has affected me a lot throughout the years. But la recompensa, mm-hmm, for what I've done, you know, outshines every problem that has come across because of that. Yo te puedo decir que lo he hecho porque nuestra situación es mucho más triste que cualquier otra. ¿Por qué? Porque son 62 años y medio. O sea, la gran mayoría del pueblo cubano ha nacido bajo una dictadura. Se ha criado, ha tenido, no conoce la libertad, no conoce las cosas buenas de vivir en una situación en que tú puedas elegir a tu gobernante, en que puedas tomar tus propias decisiones, que puedas hablar y contarle al mundo o a tu vecino la manera que tú piensas, ¿no? Y nunca han vivido eso, nunca, jamás. Entonces, para mí, a mí me duele todos los días de mi vida, todos los días de mi vida, a mí me duele la situación de mi pueblo. Fíjate, llevo 60, pasado mañana hace 60 años que llegué a Estados Unidos, el 26 de agosto de 1961. Y no sé por qué, a veces mis hijos me preguntan, pero ¿por qué a ti te pasa esto? Y yo no puedo responderlo. Es algo que lo llevo aquí adentro del corazón y no he podido, de algún modo, ni quiero deshacerme de eso. Me preocupa mucho, me preocupa, me duele. La palabra es me duele la situación de mi pueblo. Y trato por todos los medios, a través de mi música, de mis presentaciones, de entrevistas como esta, de cualquier cosas que yo pueda hacer a través de las redes sociales, enviar un mensaje de fe y esperanza para mi pueblo y a la misma vez enviar un mensaje de las necesidades básicas del ser humano, los derechos básicos del ser humano que el cubano no tiene por 62 años.
Willy, ¿qué ha sido lo, ya que este mes estás celebrando tus 62 años aquí en este gran país, que nos ha abierto las puertas a nuestros abuelos, a nuestros padres, a ti también, ¿qué es lo que más aprecias?
Aprecio levantarme todos los días en libertad. O sea, yo recuerdo cuando mi padre decidió sacarme de Cuba a través del programa de Pedro Pan, que tú dijiste hace un rato, where 14,000 Cuban children left the island without our parents, without. Some of the stories of Peter Pan are not very good. So some of them are sort of tragic because they, at the end, couldn't get back to their parents. My situation was one of the better ones. I was lucky. You know, living in freedom is the most, you can see it every day, you know, thousands of people trying to get into this country that we live in because of the freedoms that we enjoy. This is a blessing. So every day in my life when I wake up, I thank the Lord. Every night before I go to bed, I thank the Lord for living in this country that, you know, 60 years ago opened the doors for me and allowed me to achieve the American dream. That's such a blessing.
On the next SOS Cuba, we'll talk about Cuba now and what life is really like on the island today.
SOS Cuba is produced by Enrique Santos, Luisa Barona, Julio Ramirez, Harold Valenzuela, DJ Extreme, Wilber Mateu, Rosalia Castro, and Telemundo, in partnership with iHeartRadio's My Cultura Podcast Network. For more podcasts from iHeart, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.